Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health. And we begin with some good news about Catherine, Princess of Wales.
Doing what I can to stay cancer-free is now my focus. Although I have finished chemotherapy, my path to healing and full recovery is long, and I must continue to take each day as it comes.
Well, that is a clip of her announcement that she's finished her course of chemotherapy and is cancer-free. She also, as we just heard, said that there's still a long road ahead. So I think that's a good time to talk about what comes after treatment. The whole path is called survivorship. And I'm trying to avoid that word because it's just one of the cancer cliches that I hate. Never mind that. But there is a physical and emotional aftermath for both patients and their families. And it's different for everyone with some similarity. And it usually rolls into what we call a new normal. And as our listeners know, this is something I'm very familiar with. And we have a timeline for the new COVID and flu vaccines. If you'll recall, last week at this time, we had breaking news that the current shots were no longer available because the province destroyed them. Also, new guidelines for iron deficiency, which can be very important. If you have questions or comments, the number is 416-360-0740. Toll free 1-866-740-4740.
Now, time for the medical record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Fahad Razak, Canada Research Chair in Healthcare Data and Analytics at the University of Toronto and an internist at Unity Health. Dr. Elisa Naiman, a family doctor here in Toronto, and a first-time panelist, Dr. Keith Stewart, who is the Vice President for Cancer at UHN and Director of the Princess Margaret Cancer Program. Welcome to all of you, and welcome Dr. Stewart.
Thank you.
Hi, Libby.
Hi. So let's begin with Dr. Stewart on this whole business of what comes after. You know, people hear a lot about the so-called cancer journey, about treatment, but what comes after?
Well, Libby, thank you for the question. I was thinking about this earlier. I think there's three stages to this. So after people have been through a very tough period in their life, there's a physical, a mental, and a social, and you obviously have some experience with this yourself. The first is obviously physical healing. Chemotherapy is tough on the body. There is poor concentration that needs to recover, fatigue, loss of muscle mass, loss of appetite and diet, all of which take some time, many, many months probably for some patients to start to experience normality in that aspect. Then there's mental healing, which is the anxiety, the depression that sometimes follows a cancer diagnosis and even during recovery, and even post-traumatic stress, which is a very tough time for people to go through and then to experience the healing process afterwards. And then finally, I would say social, which is re-entry into normality, going back to work, interacting with family and friends in a more normal fashion, and of course the economic impact of being out of the workforce if that's happened or has caused any financial strain. I did hear the term recently, Sir Thriver, which I quite appealed to me, and I think that's what we aim to get for all of our patients.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is interesting. After my last cancer treatment, which ended not that long ago, I felt like my body was like spitting up anything that might be wrong, and it was kind of one thing after another, like things that were nothing. And eventually that's more or less passing. Elisa, what do you go through with your patients?
So I'm very fortunate to be practicing in Toronto in that usually patients, they're affiliated with one of the hospitals in the city. And what will happen will be that after they've finished their treatment, they might be part of the survivorship program, and that might continue for a couple of years. And then after that, when people have ongoing issues, or, you know, we have to get accommodations for their work environment, that's usually when I get involved. And then, as I've mentioned before on previous episodes, that often people who've had cancer when they're young, that often when something, when they feel a lymph node or they feel unwell, then their anxiety gets quite bad. And I have to take that into account when they come to see me. And we often have to potentially maybe more investigate than for other people, because the psychological impact just never seems to leave people, and this fear comes back quite quickly, and something that it's important for me as a practitioner to be very aware of, and how I manage patients who've previously had a cancer diagnosis.
Well, yeah, and there are psychologists and psychiatrists who specialize in this. Do you ever help them or refer them to try to get over the anxiety?
So initially, when it happened, when they've had their diagnosis, they're usually followed through the hospital, and it's often quite good that they can access social work or a psychiatrist that's affiliated with a cancer program. And then after that, in terms of, lots of people have really bad health anxiety, and that's a matter of helping them to find a practitioner who can help them to manage their health anxiety.
One of the interesting things, Fahad, in terms of the number of appointments, because you can still have a lot of appointments, and I remember back the first time I had cancer, and for myself and a lot of people, it can be anxiety-making when you have fewer appointments because you're afraid something might happen. And I have to say that this time it was like, get me out of here, much as I am grateful to my doctors. So I think there's probably a range of that. But even, you know, you're used to seeing your oncologist once a month or whatever, and calls from nurses and all kinds of follow up. And when it stops, just some people feel kind of abandoned, I guess.
Yeah, that's right, Libby. I think that experience of having a cancer for many patients, and I've seen this in my family, it's deeply disconcerting. It's something deep inside your body, which has started to work abnormally now, can be life-threatening, can put you through an enormous burden through the treatment and the diagnostic process. And then suddenly, at the other end of it, you're in this period where people say, well, it's been cured, or we're confident now that what was there has been removed. But what happens next? And I think that anxiety is very significant, and the lack of connection to the healthcare provider, that reassurance that things are going well, is can be very disconcerting. And you know, I think the truth is, for many patients now, there is clearly curative potential, especially if cancers are caught early, which is wonderful. But there is truly a series of screening and follow-up processes that have to happen, which again can cause additional burden. And I think that's an important part of the story here, which is that the treatments itself for cancer, whether it's surgery, it's the chemotherapy or the radiation,
or
can
the
increase
immuno.
Your risk of stroke. Or immunotherapy, that's right. Yeah, can increase your risk of side effects. So for example, I recently had a patient that I treated in hospital for cardiac issues that was a direct consequence of some of the chemotherapy that they received. Radiation to the chest or to the neck area can increase your risk of subsequent second cancers, for example, a lung cancer or a thyroid cancer that could be unrelated to the initial cancer that you had, let's say a breast cancer. And so there's a lot that happens after the first curative process has completed for that initial therapy. And we know that there's that increased risk period for many patients. We say for recurrence, it can be up to 24 months for many cancers. And then there's the side effects of the treatments as well that we have to watch out for. So there's a lot to be done. And by some estimates, all newly occurring cancers, about 10% are in fact a second unrelated cancer in a cancer survivor now.
Well, I want to point something out, as someone who's had several unrelated cancers. That's a lot better than a recurrence, because a recurrence of your cancer is considered terminal. And if it's a whole new primary cancer, well, you can get a cure. Right, Dr. Stewart?
Yeah, no, I think that's right, Libby. You stated it well.
One thing I want to get to, so we talk about the patient and the anxiety. I know that with the screening, you know, your follow-up CT or whatever it is, people get really anxious, and it can be for a long time, like, I don't know, a week or a couple of weeks before and after. But let's talk about family members, because I think, you know, it's not necessarily over that quickly for them either, Dr. Stewart.
No, I think this is it's been an understudied area, and an area we're starting to pay a lot more attention to, which is the caregiver. I mean, it has huge impacts on families and their family members, and particularly the people who become the primary caregiver of a cancer patient. And I don't think that ends the day that the cancer therapy is over, for all the reasons I mentioned before about reintegration. And I think this issue of caregiver support is becoming critically important. 40% of us will be diagnosed with a cancer in our lifetime. Caught early, almost 90% of some cancers can be cured. So there's a big burden of people out there, not burden, actually, that's the wrong term. There are a large number of people out there like yourself who have survived cancer, and we really do need to think about how we can support their families as well.
And Elisa, is there a difference between or among caregivers if it's a cancer that they had in their family, or if it's another disease, or even something like dementia? I mean, is there a difference in the impact on family members?
I think there is. I think it sort of depends just in terms of what the diagnosis is, and if people know conditions run in their families, whether it be, let's say, ALS or Huntington's or any type of cancer, their approach and how they look at things is much different than if somebody just has another cancer. And what's very interesting is that people think that just because other family members have that cancer that they're going to get it. And if, let's say, in your family nobody has breast cancer and then you get breast cancer, then you wonder, how is this possible and how did it happen? So it's quite fascinating. And often people have these ideas when other family members will die at a certain age, and they think that this is their destiny and that they're going to die at a particular age, and they're quite surprised if they make it past. It's very interesting that some people will have this idea that I'm predestined to die at, let's say, age 69 because everybody else in my family has. And it usually isn't the case, but lots of people will come in with this concept for how long they're going to live and how they're going to die.
That's really interesting. I suppose so. I mean, the other thing is that, you know, there are clear sort of guidelines to when you may be at risk for a familial cancer, but most cancer is sporadic. And I know people who had a family member who had a cancer that was definitely sporadic, and they went on to get what I thought were, you know, really invasive tests. That I would have said, gee, you know, I'm not sure that's necessary, Fahad.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's and, you know, it touches on a topic we've talked about frequently on your panel, which is the balance between increased screening and the benefit that can come from that, whether it's to lower ages or lower risk groups or extending the age into older individuals. But there's also the trade-off between the burden of the testing. And, you know, there was a really important paper that came out in the in one of our main medical journals in the past week that showed that, for example, with enhanced screening, you find more false positives. You find things which are not cancer, but you're unsure, and it creates a cascade, whether it's additional testing, maybe a biopsy, maybe enhanced screening. And those patients, once they get through the process and they realize that, in fact, it was a false call, the initial thing that was identified was not a cancer, subsequently, they can be less likely to go through even the recommended screening at that point. So there's this trade-off that happens that's really important to consider.
Okay, you know, I was going to get to that study, and it was interesting because another thing that we discussed here, the whole question of whether to lower the age for breast screening from 50 to 40, which they've done in the United States and I think in some other provinces, but did not do here. And advocates were upset about that. But what exactly what you're talking about is happening now, and those false positives are more likely in younger women. And as a result, those younger women, a lot of them are less likely to continue with screening, Dr. Stewart.
Well, Libby, first of all, Ontario Health is funding now.
They are.
Starting October, they're going to start allowing women from the age of 40 upwards to undergo mammography.
Right,
between 40 and 50 years old, it is voluntary. It's not, you're not going to get a letter in the mail. You sort of self-identify that you want screening. But that is happening. I think it's launching in October, actually.
Right, so but it's not the sort of mass screening.
Well, it's available to anybody over 40, but they have to request it. It's not like you're going to get a letter in the mail saying you're overdue. So you have to actually request it, is my understanding. But it is happening. And there will be quite a large increase in number of younger women undergoing screening because of that. And the issues you've just brought up in terms of false positives are for sure an issue. But we have to balance that, of course, with the advantages of finding cancer early.
Mm-hmm. Alisa, what's your take on that?
It's something that when women come in their 40s and we have a conversation about when they want to start screening, we talk in terms of this very high likelihood that, especially the very first time that you go for breast screening, that you're going to be called back, and the anxiety and stress that it will cause, and that you will be called back and you will have additional mammography views done, potentially an ultrasound. And do people want to go ahead and have that test done? And it's something that is probably the most important point about counseling for just somebody who's at routine risk of breast cancer in their 40s, that you do have a high likelihood that you will get called back. And what is the anxiety that happened? I just had somebody today who's been called back, and I get a phone call saying that they're very anxious and what's going on. So this does happen a lot, and people do need to be aware of it.
I have to say, Alisa, I'm really impressed with the kind of counseling that you do, because I think, not that many people benefit from that. You know, somebody would think, okay, yes, I want to go ahead at a young age. And if they're called back, they're totally not prepared for that.
No, absolutely. You have to be informed about the callback. The callback is actually very anxiety provoking. At some locations, the callback and the recall will happen quite quickly Then people get nervous about that. And other people, they could be sitting and waiting for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month to go back, and they have to continue on. And everybody knows somebody who has breast cancer, and most people, their first reaction when they get the call back is that they think that they also do have breast cancer. So when you advise people that this is a high likelihood and it does not mean that you have cancer, and most likely it doesn't, then people understand that they're going to get called back, and that this is generally part of a process that occurs to ensure that the screening is complete and that there's no sign of cancer.
Okay. Fahad, we got news about a timeline for the new COVID and flu shots beginning of October, which is earlier than I thought for people at risk, and later in October for the rest of us. So what do you think of that?
I think it's good that there's finally some certainty around this. As you know, and we talked about, I think, in the last couple of weeks, it looks like there was some miscommunication between the federal government. So the regulator and approval for each new round of vaccines comes from the federal government, but then the delivery of that vaccine comes from the provincial government. And there seemed to be some miscommunication that resulted in potentially a gap period in September where the few remaining patients who are high risk that haven't been vaccinated in this latest round would have had a hard time getting access to a vaccine. And you want to avoid that because the goal at this stage of the pandemic is not to vaccinate everybody, and it's not these regular cycles for everybody, but it's to try and get higher rates of vaccination within higher risk groups. So, for example, people over the age of 65, people who are immunocompromised. And we know because the virus continues to mutate very quickly, that you want to try and match that vaccine against what's circulating. So right now, we have a variant called KP, which is circulating widely. A year ago, the vaccines were based on something called XBB, which is a variant that's no longer very common. So ideally, you want to match the variant today, KP, with the vaccine you're giving as you enter respiratory virus season.
That was one thing I wanted to clarify. So is the early group, is that people over 65 and immunocompromised, or is it just people in nursing homes? Like it used to be.
Yeah, I haven't seen clarity on that, Libby. I did see the higher risk wording in the official national statement, which is put out by NACI, which is the Vaccine Guideline Committee federally. High risk is equally considered to be over the age of 65 or in long-term care or other high-risk settings like congregate care or having an immunocompromising condition, and then a few other groups. So they consider those all to be uniformly high risk, but within province, they may have additional prioritization. And, you know, it wouldn't be unreasonable, for example, to prioritize long-term care for those initial few weeks. I should add that, of course, on top of this, there's always the other strategies that continue to be effective. So don't expose people if you're sick, or don't go into a high-risk setting if you're especially high-risk and haven't been vaccinated recently. And then, of course, improving ventilation and other things. Those continue to work independent of the vaccines.
Okay, but so we should get some clarity on that at some point, right?
That's right. Yeah, I think in the next couple of weeks, that's right.
Okay, one more quick topic having time with, and that is a change in the guidelines for diagnosing iron deficiency. And I know, Dr. Stewart, when it comes to getting chemo and stuff, iron levels are really important. So, but I don't know if this applies to people who are taking treatment.
Well, I think what I understand has happened is that the was considered to be a low level has been increased from a number of 10 to a number of 30, so more people would fall into the category of being iron deficient by that definition. This means that particularly for women pre-menopause, that where iron deficiency is very common, that this would mean more people would be being prescribed oral iron therapy to replace the iron, because it's very easy to treat with taking, you know, a couple of pills a day, or if you can't tolerate those, getting a intravenous infusion. So I think this is going to be very helpful for particularly for young women who very frequently have iron deficiency. The only downside I could see to it is that there may be people who fall into the category of iron deficient now who will need to undergo a workup to find out why they're iron deficient. It's often from bleeding, for example, from the bowel. And that may perhaps not be necessary in everybody. So that may increase the number of people being screened and some of the complications of that, what we just talked about with breast cancer screening as well. But I think overall, probably a good thing, particularly to bring equity into the system for younger women.
And Elisa, I mean, is that going to sort of solve mysteries about why some young women are feeling tired or just, you know, not feeling right?
I think you're right on some level. You know, often any female who has a period on, usually on a monthly basis, will complain of fatigue, and because they're just losing blood every month. So this is a very, very common, and it really impacts people's quality of life. And what I've noticed is, so the lab companies, they actually had different lower standards for what would be a definition of being anemic. And so let's say somebody had an iron of 17. So in the past, they would not be considered to be anemic, but now with the new guideline, they actually would. And before that, we would be like, okay, well, you don't need to go on take iron supplementation. And they would just continue to be tired, complain about not feeling well, not having energy, feeling cold. Often people would feel like they would get sick more frequently. People could get restless leg syndrome. And just from experience in working, I often would say to people, even though your number doesn't meet the definition, I often find that women will feel better once we get their iron up into the high 20s or low 30s. So I was quite happy to see that they've changed the cutoff. And so that right now, then now we'll be able to have more people who would be getting treatment, who before might not be considered to have a problem, and they would just continue to suffer and be tired.
Okay. Fahad, anything to add on the iron question?
Yeah, just delighted to see this. It was pushed ahead by two very close colleagues, Dr. Michelle Schulzberg, who's a hematologist at my hospital at St. Michael's, and Menica Pai, who's a hematologist at McMaster. And this has been a very important advocacy campaign because, as you heard from Alyssa, the symptoms are often very non-specific, but very significant for quality of life. And it disproportionately affects women and low-income groups. And they're all often just brushed off by the medical system and said, there's nothing wrong with you. And now we can clearly say, here's a group of people who would benefit from therapy. And hopefully that's going to improve the way they feel and the way they function.
Well, and congratulations to your colleagues. I think as we wrap things up, that's also a reminder that everything in our healthcare system requires advocacy and pushing for it. So that's another thing to keep in mind. And this is good news. And we're out of time. And thank you so much, Dr. Fahad Razak, Dr. Alyssa Naiman, and Dr. Keith Stewart. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay. We are taking a break. And when we come back, I'm so frustrated online lately just by all the increasing requirements by people who want all my information and things that are messing up. So we're going to talk to Carmi Levy about that when we come back.